Doesn't start till Esther says it starts.
That's right.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, May 30th, 2012. It's 10 a.m. We're here in the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We have a regular biweekly commission meeting scheduled for this morning. For the record, and for anyone who may be listening in, this is Commissioner Tony Clark. I'd like to welcome everyone today.
Good morning, Kevin Kramer. Welcome.
Good morning, Brian Kalk, and welcome as well.
With that, there's some items on consent.
I'd move passage of consent.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. There are two items in my portfolio this morning. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, issuing corridor certificate number 135 and route permit number 147 to Elite, Inc., authorizing construction of approximately 11 miles of 230 kV electric transmission line and associated facilities in Mercer, Morton, and Oliver counties of North Dakota, case number PU-11-620.
Second.
It's a pretty straightforward transmission line, 11 miles long. It's being proposed by Elite Clean Energy, which is a subdivision of Minnesota Power, and it would provide transmission access to potential future wind farms that Elite Clean Energy is looking into in the Mercer, Morton, and Oliver counties of North Dakota. And it this 11 miles of line would hook into the Bison substation, which would permit those to go online should they find willing buyers.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC2, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-12-219, canceling warehouse license number 747, issued to Archer Daniels Midland Company at Walhalla, North Dakota, and ordering that business at Walhalla is discontinued effective immediately.
Second.
This is a result of a request that the PSC received from Archer's Daniel ADM, and it's no longer needed as ADM is closing the ethanol plant in Walhalla.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio. Commissioner Kalk.
Good morning. Item BK1 has been withdrawn, so I'll move to item BK2. Item BK2 has many different case numbers. What I will do is, thank you for the recommendation, Commissioner Clark. I move the commission issue a notice of consolidated hearing concerning the proposed switched access price schedule of those companies published in the notice.
Second.
Basically, what we have is a 21 different companies that filed through May 15th of May 17th of this year the revised interstate switched access price schedule to reflect newly enacted FCC rules pursuant to the recent FCC order. On May 30th, earlier today, the Commission suspended the interstate switched access price schedule filed in the cases listed. A public hearing in this matter will be held beginning June 21st at 8:30 a.m. in the Commission hearing room.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Item BK3. I move the Commission publish notice of the 2012-2013 telecommunications relay service surcharge in the daily newspapers of general circulation in the state of North Dakota, case number PU-12224.
Second.
On April 21st of 1993, Governor Schaefer approved House Bill 1028 that established a program to provide specialized telecommunications services and equipment to the communication impaired. This relay service program is funded by an access line surcharge paid by the customers of local exchange companies and radio communication service providers. The Commission has calculated the 2012-2000 surcharge to be introduced in bills to customers as 4 cents per access line per month.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 And items BK4 through BK6 are dealing with call before you dig, so I'll go through each one of them. Item BK4, I move the Commission adopt the consent order and Public Service Commission's damage prevention enforcement action concerning Summit Energy, case number GS-12-55.
Second.
Based on an investigation completed by our staff, it was determined that on January 9th, 2012, Summit Energy personnel began an excavation as defined under North Dakota Century Code while exploring for scoria in McKenzie County, North Dakota. Staff also concluded that Summit Energy personnel did not provide an excavation or location notice as required by state law at least 48 hours before the excavation. Summit Energy did not notify Belle Fouche of the evacuation, and therefore there could have been no agreement between Summit Energy and Belle Fouche under North Dakota Century Code. It's been concluded that the evacuation was not made in time of emergency. Summit Energy violated North Dakota Century Code Section 49-2304 by failing to contact the Notification Center, North Dakota One Call, and provide an excavation or location notice at least 48 hours before beginning its excavation. The commission is authorized to impose fines up to $5,000. In this case, Summit Energy acknowledges that at the time of signing the consent to entry of order, it's been advised of all its rights. And we come down to Summit Energy agrees to pay a fine of $1,000 payable to the North Dakota Public Service Commission within 10 days effective of this order.
All in favor?
Aye.
Item BK5. I move the commission adopt the consent order in the Public Service Commission Damage Prevention Enforcement Action concerning ProPipe Corporation, case number 12-57.
Second.
Based on an investigation, staff determined that on October 12, 2011, ProPipe called for a location ticket for work to begin on October 14th for the purpose of pipeline trenching in McKenzie County, North Dakota. Staff also determined that on December 6th, ProPipe personnel began an excavation as defined by North Dakota Century Code. We'll just note that the one call was initially called for October 12th, but digging didn't begin until December 6th. So based on a lot of information put together, staff concluded that ProPipe personnel was operated under an expired one call ticket and therefore did not provide an excavation or location notice as required by state law. It was not made during time of emergency, and there was no agreements entered into by the two groups. North Dakota law says we are authorized up to $5,000. And in this case, ProPipe agrees to pay a fine of $1,000 payable to the North Dakota Public Service Commission within 10 days of the effective date of this order.
All in favor?
Aye.
And finally, I move the commission adopt the consent order in the Public Service Commission's Damage Prevention Enforcement Action concerning S.J. Lewis Construction, case number GS12-53.
Second.
Staff determined between January 5th, 2012 and January 20th of 2012, S.J. Lewis personnel began an excavation as defined under North Dakota Century Code to install an underground water line in Ward County, North Dakota. Staff concluded that S.J. personnel did not provide an excavation or location notice as required by state law at least 48 hours before the excavation. S.J. Lewis did not notify Ox Sable of the evacuation, and there was no agreement between the two companies. It was not during time of emergency, and it violated North Dakota Century Code. We, as the previous orders, were authorized to fine up to $5,000. In this case, there was no damage actually that took place. S.J. Construction agrees to pay a fine of $500 payable to North Dakota PSC within 10 days of the effective date of this order. I would just add that, you know, there's a lot of these that came through today, but I think it's just a realization that the companies are now filing the complaints. And once they file them with the staff, it's pretty easy for us to go back and see if they've got a one-call ticket. But still, the main goal here is for people to quit calling or to call before they dig and just quit digging out there.
All in favor?
Aye.
That concludes the items in my portfolio.
Thank you, Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. KC1 and KC2 were mislabeled and were just taken up in Brian's portfolio, so we'll go to KC3. I move the commission to execute a contract with Bronco Brothers, Inc. in the amount of $607,510 for construction services at the Columbus Phase 13 AML project in Burke County.
Second.
Of course, there have been 12 previous phases to the Columbus AML project, and we're now on 13 and 14, I think, this year. It involves backfilling some mine high walls, grading some spoil piles at an abandoned mine, of course, south of Columbus. There will be about 590,000 cubic feet of dirt that will need to be moved, some of its mine spoil and other earthen materials, to backfill the high walls, and it'll be carried out on about 85 acres. The bid opening for the project was held on April 23rd, and 9 bids were received, this one, of course, being the lowest one. The other bids ranged from $680,000 to just under $1.5 million. And our project manager, and this has not happened for a few years, actually, but estimated it to be at $800,000. So the bids, some bids actually came in below our estimate, which has been, which is a nice relief. So anyway, the notice of intent was awarded to Barranco Brothers on April 27th. None of the other bidders filed a complaint or questioned it. So today we're issuing the award.
All in favor?
Aye.
KC4. I move the commission execute a contract with Riley Brothers Contracting, Inc. in the amount of $925,675 for construction services at the Columbus Phase 14 AML project in Burke County.
Second.
This project involves the leveling of some mine spoil piles and then applying some soil amendments and seeding of 350 acres and then installation of erosion control measures and some fencing around the Columbus AML site. This application of soil amendments and the seeding includes areas that have been or will be backfilled in previous phases of the project, including phases 11, 12, and then and 13, which we just talked about and voted on. Bid opening for the Phase 14 project was also held on April 23rd, and five bids were received, the low one being from Riley Brothers, Inc. of Morris, Minnesota, in the amount of $925,675. Other bids ranged from $966,250 to just under $1.3 million. And again, our staff estimated that it would be about a $1.2 million project, so coming in, over $200,000 below the estimate is always helpful. There's plenty of money in the AML budget to take care of this project. So everything looks to be in good order, and I think the contractors are anxious to get to work. It's been a good construction season so far. So,
all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC5. I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent to shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a siting application to 4 weeks and assess a filing fee of $7,500 due upon filing a siting application in case number PU-12-190 Highland Operating LLC's 6-inch existing natural gas pipeline and divide in Burke County's North Dakota.
Second.
Yes, I said existing. This is a situation where Highland, under the impression that they were going to put in a what they thought, I guess, the under the impression that it was a gas gathering line, realized eventually that it was probably more properly should be identified as a natural gas intrastate pipeline. It is only 6.5 miles long, 6-inch steel pipeline from the Norse gas plant in Divide County to the WBI transmission line tie in Burke County. So that's only 6.5 miles. It does. Include two counties. At any rate, they were, at the time, as I said, of construction, unaware that it would require siting, eventually became aware, notified the commission on their own, and then filed this letter of intent. So it's the pipe carries about 10 to 20 million cubic feet of natural gas per day from the Norris plant to the WBI transmission line tie-in and has a maximum capacity of about 20 million cubic feet per day. What we're doing today, of course, is noticing the letter of intent, and we'll have eventually talk about the hearing process. I recall doing this one other time, and maybe we've done it more than once, but there was it was an MDU line in eastern North Dakota that was in service and then came to the realization it wasn't distribution, I think, in that case, but rather an intrastate transmission line. We cited it after the fact. It worked out just fine. Everything else is the same, this study area and route permit. And in that case, as I recall, we'll have to talk about this, I guess. I think we actually did an informal hearing, so this is a little shorter, and we'll talk about all the processes after a bit.
All in favor?
Aye.
And KC6. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, issuing certificate of corridor compatibility number 135 and route permit number 146 to Enbridge Pipelines, North Dakota LLC for the construction of its Berthold Station expansion project in Ward County, North Dakota for the transmission of crude oil, case number PU-11232.
Second.
This is sort of deja vu-ish. Is that a word? Deja vu. Anyway, this is an expansion of an expansion of the Berthold Station, which is growing to continually meet the growing demand for for transmission of crude oil out of the Bakken, of course. You might recall, it seems like last week, but I suppose it was last year sometime, we approved the expansion of the Berthold Station to involve several truck stations and expanded piping and tankage on the east side of the railroad tracks. Now, with growing demands, the reversal of the portal line, the expansion of the Enbridge North Dakota line, they are now expanding on the west side of the railroad tracks to include a rail facility. And while we don't cite the rail facility, we do cite all of the tankage, the piping, and pumping stations, whatever else is required to get that oil into the get that oil to the rail facility. Involves, I think, purchase of about 80 acres of land, another 240 acres possibly purchased or leased, a lot of future growth and development there. Had a very good hearing on the project in Berthold. And while it's not a huge footprint in terms of miles and numbers of landowners and all of that, it's important because, of course, it's right on the edge of a city. And one of the interesting synergies I took away from this particular project was that because of its position next to Berthold and the fact that there is a rather large grain handling facility there in Berthold Grain, it actually provided an opportunity for Berthold Grain's seasonal employees to have more permanent employment. They'll also be helping out with the rail facility that is being built next to the tracks there. Also, because of the expansion, there's additional trackage. The passing lane, as I call it, there at Berthold, is actually able to be moved further out of town, if you will. Currently, when trains meet at Berthold, there's a track that where the train stops and straddles Main Street and can hold up traffic for some time. And now with this facility, that'll actually be moved west, and that'll no longer be an issue. There are some issues that, you know, increased traffic issues, of course, as a result of this, that moves trucks and more, probably more inconveniently for a few landowners, forces them to use a particular road that crosses Highway 2. But all of that's outside of our jurisdiction, and we heard the concerns, and hopefully the company is working, and I'm pretty confident the company is working with local officials to help diminish the negative impact of that as much as possible. So everything seems to be in order. The entire cost of this project is, as I recall, $102 million, but let me look real quick to make sure that's right, $102.5 million for these upgrades. So everything seems to be in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
KC7, speaking of Enbridge. I move the commission issue a notice of filing, notice of informal hearing, and notice of opportunity for hearing in the request for amendment of tree and shrub mitigation specifications for case number PU-10-613, Enbridge Pipelines, North Dakota, LLC, Beaver Lodge Loop Project, Williams, Montreal, and Ward Counties, North Dakota.
Second.
Again, this is a familiar project. We've already cited it, already issued the permit and the corridor certificate. Enbridge is requesting an amendment to the tree and shrub mitigation plan. Our tree and shrub mitigation plan states that when you're going through a shelter belt or a wooded area, that you remove 50 feet, a width of 50 feet of trees. They're asking in a short space here, about 200 feet, that they be allowed to expand it to 125 feet. Having been on a few pipeline construction sites, and especially, as I recall, the Trans-Canada Keystone Line in the very wooded areas of the Pembina Gorge, I can see why a company might want to expand that. And while we hate to see more trees cut down, safety really is a major factor in the construction of a pipeline. And so I think everything seems to be in order. The mitigation of those trees, that those rules remain the same. I mean, they have to be replaced and whatnot. And while it's a little bit wider scar, if you will, for a few years, everything seems to be appropriate. The request seems to be appropriate. So anyway, we're issuing the notice of opportunity for hearing, and we'll hear more about it, I'm sure.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends items in my portfolio.
Very good. And that ends the items on the agenda. As far as future meetings, we have a three-week gap now between our this meeting and our next one, which is scheduled for Wednesday, June 20th at 10 a.m. And then that afternoon there are informal hearings that are scheduled. There are no informal hearings scheduled for this afternoon. There is, however, a work session coming up between now and then, June 18th. We have Northern States Power Company, Fargo to St. Cloud, 345 CapEx transmission line siting case. Remains to be seen whether I will or will not be at any of those meetings. With that, are there any questions?
The Enbridge, the project that was just discussed, what is the corridor they want?
They want 125
feet. 125 feet. Yeah. So they want to go from 50 to 125 feet?
Yeah.
And they can cut down the trees.
That's right. They can cut down the trees and make a wider swath and for safety reasons and work. Frankly, 50 feet is a very narrow area to work in a forested area.
And where is this? And this would be corridor of the project?
No, or? It's just 200 feet. It's a very small, frankly, part of it. Let me see if I've got a more specific. It would. This won't help you much. Let's see. The width of clear cuts through windbreaks, shelter belts, and all other wooded areas shall be limited to 50 feet or less unless otherwise approved by the commission, which is what we're doing. In their letter, which was dated May 2nd, they requested we amend paragraph 8 of the tree and shrub mitigation specification for tracks number BB8218, BB8219-1, and so on. On the west half of Enbridge's Beaver Lodge Loop project, it's request an increase in clearing of trees and shrubs restricted to a length of approximately 200 feet on a couple of these tracks, and then a combined 1,500 feet on a couple of other tracks. So in total, it's less than 2,000 feet, and they're not contiguous feet.
So which county is this in?
This is in...
do you have any geographic location at all?
I have lots of tract numbers. They're wholly in Mount Trail.
Okay. So they want to cut 125-foot swath of trees on approximately, 1,700 feet of...
That's right. About 1,900 feet.
1,900 feet in Montreal County.
That's right.
Finding 125 linear feet of trees in Montreal County isn't easy.
I was going to ask about that, actually. I mean, is this really going to be a problem, or are there that many trees in that?
Well, there must be, or they wouldn't make the request.
Answered. Yeah. I'm unclear about the expansion project. I mean, what can you tell me what it is?
It's specifically to move more oil via rail. So what it does is it expands the Berthold station to accommodate the adjacent rail facility that they're also building. And let me get you exactly the upgrade involves. The ability to deliver up to 31,000 more barrels per day yet this year, and by first quarter or second quarter of next year, up to 70,000 barrels per day, all of it via rail. So the expansion on the west side of the tracks is specifically to meet the opportunity to move more oil by rail.
Okay.
Do you know how many rail stations like this there are in North Dakota?
There are somewhere between, depending on where they are in the construction phase, somewhere between 9 and 12. That I'm familiar with. Each of them has a capacity of anywhere from 60 to 120,000 barrels per day, depending on how fast you can load a unit train car.
It's impressive both how many of these have come up just in a fairly short amount of time, but also the amount of takeaway capacity that they have. If someone would have told me a few years ago that we'd be number two in oil production, I don't know that I would have believed them by this point. And then to add on top of that, that now something around 25% of the oil in the state is taken away by trains is rather remarkable. And it fills a very interesting niche in the oil transportation business. And we heard a lot about it at the Williston Basin Conference over the last week. Not only is it appears to be a good interim solution while oil pipelines are getting built out, but it also provides some flexibility that oil pipelines don't always have. From just a pure efficiency standpoint, pipelines are almost always the best, most efficient, safest way to get oil to market. At the same time, trains have some flexibility to drop into specific markets that pipelines don't, and there can be a premium for that. So it's become an important part of the solution to North Dakota's oil pipeline bottleneck.
Yeah, are these all BN?
No. No, they're not. Most of them are. However, both the Canadian Pacific and the BNSF have facilities. In fact, In fact, a good number of them, and I wish I knew the breakout and I could find that for you, Dave, but a good number of them are in that northern tier where the CP Rail goes right through the heart of the Bakken country.
Is this affected at all by the labor work stoppage?
Well, I haven't heard that it is yet, but it certainly has that potential, I would think. I've not talked to anybody specifically about it. I should put a call into Herb Jones, probably.
I just want to make sure the project that we're talking
this
about.
This is a BNSF project.
Yeah, yeah. The project that we're talking about, the Enbridge Pipeline, KC6, is to build a rail loading facility.
Well, I hesitate to put it that way because we don't site rail loading facilities.
How would you put it?
I would put it this is an expansion of the Berthold Station to accommodate the movement of more oil by rail, to accommodate the movement of oil to the rail facility that is also under construction. Certainly it's adjacent. One might argue, we never have, but someone might argue it's actually part of an associated facility, but we've determined that rail is not associated.
What is the
infrastructure we are citing are some is additional piping as well as some tankage. Those are the main things, and then all of this little things that are associated with tankage and piping to get it to the loading facility itself.
So this is infrastructure that will serve a rail loading facility that is being constructed?
That is being constructed right next to the existing facility.
Right, and the existing facility is essentially a pipe. It's a pipeline receiving.
It's a pipeline receiving station, huge pumping station, receives oil both by truck. In fact, I think it's 8 or 9 truck loading facilities or unloading stations at this particular pumping station, as well as pipeline, of course.
As I understand, the station right now is to put oil into a pipeline, and it's being expanded to also put oil onto a train.
Onto a train, that's okay. Right. It's actually two pipelines, to be technical about it, yeah.
This is the hearing that we had a while back, related hearing, where there was a lot of increased truck traffic around Berthold that they finally got that worked out. And one of the things with the expanded rail is it's good for oil industry now, but down the road this could have some positive impacts for our ag industry as well. See how that all plays out.
How would that happen? Would they start putting grain in the oil cars?
No, but once you get those handling facilities in place, you could use containers to do lots of different things. Mine has been trying to get a container yard for years to make it work, and we got a lot of empty containers that they're sitting in North Dakota. There's potential with preservation of ag products.
Yeah, and in fact, the manager of the local grain elevator in Berthold testified at the hearing in favor of the rail loading facility. I don't know that it was specifically in relationship to the grain elevator, but with this extra capacity track that'll be at this facility, it will allow the trains to not be backed up so much in Berthold when they're there, so it's not blocking traffic in a way that it currently is.
Are there any zoning problems with or zoning concerns with this particular thing?
I would say that in the case of Berthold, their mayor testified. He's testified at, I think, every hearing we've had with regard to this project, and they have assured us, and of course it's always a condition of our permits as well, so they've worked everything out. If there were ever any issues with the local jurisdictions, not just the city but also the township. Also, Dale, I mean, say, having talked to a lot of people on this very topic, the juxtaposition of the movement of liquids, whether it's oil or natural gas liquids, along with agricultural commodities. In the early stages, there were, you know, some questions and perhaps some concerns raised, mainly out of not really knowing what was going to happen. I think I've seen a lot of synergies. I mean, I think most people have accepted that that when you take an existing facility, like a major railroad, and we have them, obviously, and you add capacity is really what they've done. You've taken the existing capacity and you've filled it up with more investment, movement of more products. You're sharing the cost of the existing sunk asset, if you will, with more industries. That has a synergistic value to the existing customers. Now, could you get to a point where that could get congested or create some bottlenecks and all of that, and that could create some tension? Perhaps it could. But as we know, railroad tracks sit empty an awful lot of the day. And so having more product move on it, plus you share the investment expense of improvements. And so I think all in all, it's worth watching, and we'll certainly be watching it closely, but I think it has great potential to be a win-win for all the industries that use the rail.
So when you talk about synergies, you're talking about the ties that bind?
The ties that bind, of course. Yeah. No, that isn't what I was talking about, but I'll take it.
And also you're saying that there's potential for the upgrading of the network.
There's no question. And some of that's already taking place. There's tremendous opportunity and potential for upgrading the existing rail and the entire network because, of course, you have this very big new customer with a very high-value product.
The I wanted to go through the AMLs. Can you tell me what the – on KC3, what is the company's name, please, and what's the size of the contract?
Barranco Brothers.
Barranco, can you spell that?
Barranco, B-A-R-A-N-K-O. A-N-K-O. Did I do that right, Jim?
Barranco?
Barranco. Barranco.
I'm sorry, B-R-A-N-K-O?
B-A.
B-A.
R-A-N-K-O.
Oh, B-A-R-A-N-K-O.
Barranco. Brothers.
Barranco Brothers.
And they're in Dickinson.
In Dickinson.
They're great guys, yeah.
Okay, yes, I think I've spoken to one of the Barranco Brothers at one point. And how much is the contract for?
$607,000 to $510.
And, okay, and the other one is for Riley Brothers, Inc. of Morris, 925-675.
That's correct.
In Burke County, 350 acres approximately.
Right.
And where is the... Is the Barranco Brothers contract also in Burke County?
It is. It's the same mine. And it's the Barranco Brothers contract is more to move the – I'm going to really simplify this, but to move the dirt into the hole, if you will.
Okay.
Okay. Then the Riley Brothers, their contract is more for the finishing of the reclamation process. So they're going to be finishing up after the Barranco Brothers, but also after phases 11 and 12, which were previously done. So it's really – one piece moving the dirt and getting the topsoil back in place, and the next phase being the finishing, if you will, of the landscape.
And this is a 350-acre site?
It is. Now, Barranco Brothers, their portion of it is about 85 acres. But when you take phases 11 and 12 and add it to phase 13, which is what the Barranco Brothers are doing, you have about 350 acres that will be finished off by Riley Brothers.
Okay. On the S.J. Lewis construction $500 fine, what did... Did they? I'm unclear as to what they damaged.
They didn't damage anything in that last one. That's why the fine was $500 by $1,000. The proposed fine.
They just dug without permission.
That is correct. And then the company, I think it was Ox Sable, who it was here.
I think so. Yep.
Yeah, Ox Sable. They basically filed the complaint, and it was a valid complaint. But as we go through, I guess assessing the amount of the fine, now this is our 10th one of those. Basically, we look at if there's damage, if there's loss of life. I mean, all those things kind of come into it as we create a matrix of how I look at it, if there's repeat fines. As we walk through this is the 10th one the commission has ever done, so it's still relatively new. Just want to make sure we've got a good methodology in place as we determine the right steps.
And where was it that they dug?
Let me look here.
The Ox Sable.
The Ox Sable was underground water line in Ward County, North Dakota. I've got the township and range numbers.
Do you know where it is, like in relationship to Minot?
I will have to look. I've got the township numbers, but I don't know.
Ox Sable, what do they do?
They actually are a gas processing company. They're affiliated with, or I guess part of the same ownership team as Alliance Pipeline. But Ox Sable largely does more of the processing. They have a huge plant, or maybe multiple plants in the Chicago area. They've also recently bought some assets in North Dakota. They purchased, I think, the EOG plant. Is that right? Do you remember, Brian? I think it was the EOG plant in Stanley, if I remember right. And I think they've also purchase the Pecan Pipeline? Yeah, which is a midstream line that runs from, I think, Stanley to Towner, if I remember right, and hooks up with the Alliance, something like that, 70-mile line. All these pipelines start looking the same to me. But
well, anyway, they have an interest in making sure people don't dig without permission. Is that why they...
Sure. They do, and they have a tradition of carrying it out. I mean, Ox Sable and Alliance, if there are any two companies that have sort of led the charge on the call before you dig and trying to get some teeth into the law, it's been those two companies.
So, in other words, these these folks didn't have their pipe damage, but they could have.
Correct. The if you look at the companies that have filed, I mean, it's Aux Sable, Bill Fouche Pipeline has filed. This is the third case, Whiting Oil and Gas, New Star Pipeline. I mean, the pipeline companies, I think they've gone down almost zero tolerance. If they see something, they report it, which is a good thing.
It is a good thing. What's so funny about it, what's somewhat amusing to me about it is in the case of the pipeline companies, they're both sometimes victim and sometimes perpetrator because they do a lot of digging. And as you know, some of our more serious violations have been literally in putting pipelines into the ground. So when we start seeing both the perpetrator and the victim become the same person, you start seeing more cooperation. And I think that is what we're seeing as we move into this next legislative session. I would expect a fairly aggressive move toward beefing up our call before you dig laws. The interesting thing about today's this one we're talking about, the Aux Sable one, the $500 fine, where there was no damage done but rather a violation in advance of damage, that's really sort of what you want to get to, I would think, because the whole point of the call before you dig law is to help people comply with the law, not to punish them after they don't. So that was the purpose of giving the commission this sort of authority, which we always had, but sort of an emphasis on the commission doing some more of this sort of violation before a damage, because the point of the law is to avoid damages, not to punish
people. How long have you had authority to fine?
Yeah, that's a good question. We think probably for a very long time, okay. But the issue was raised the session before last, I believe.
Raleigh Brothers Construction was the first case that we actually levied a fine, and that was almost, 18 months ago now?
Yeah, we were looking for something to do.
Right.
Basically what happened, we had, for some period of time, these hadn't been brought, and while there had been no commission determination, I think there was an assumption that because the one-call law itself does not have enforcement provisions as far as civil penalties, there was something that we may not have that enforcement authority. Upon second look, several years ago, while there is no penalty provision within the one-call law, there are general laws of applicability that the commission has. And so these fines actually come through the more general statutes for the commission enforcing its orders. And as Kevin suggested, maybe there'll be a look at beefing up the one-call law itself. But this is just our general authority.
And ProPipe Corporation, what was damaged there?
Let's look here. What number was that?
GS-1257.
Oil pipeline was damaged.
Same thing, yes, exactly. The Bill Fouche Pipeline, damaged oil pipeline.
And
County.
Okay. The Bill Fouche oil pipeline was damaged?
In McKenzie County, yeah.
Do you know if there's any spill or any consequences as a result?
There was none reported. Okay. So
how about Summit Energy?
Same thing.
Oil pipeline?
No low-kick damaged oil pipeline, Bill Fouche pipeline. And that would be in, making sure that's the same.
I think that's McKenzie County.
McKenzie County as well.
Okay.
Even if there's not a spill, there's significant events, because what happens is you have to repair the pipe after any sort of third-party damage. Oftentimes,
just a nick.
That's why it's unreported damage on pipelines is so dangerous, because what it does is it creates a spot where there can be corrosion, where you create a weak spot in the pipe. And across the country, what you'll see is a number of accidents that maybe happen weeks or days or years later were actually the result of third-party damage that weren't reported at the time that it happened, which is why it's important that they do get reported.
When does the new telecom charge go into effect?
It goes into effect. I wonder if it's not next month. Let's look here. I would imagine July 1st.
July 1st. What is the charge presently?
I don't know off the top of my head. Where's Pat? 4 cents.
It's 4 cents still?
It didn't change from last year.
Didn't change, okay.
I'm curious why the NSP cases or Xcel were withdrawn again.
Sure, we basically in the part about the Department of Energy settlement, there was a portion of that we included in the rate case, and there's now additional settlement amounts coming. And so we thought about trying to amend the case, but then we decided against that. Just leave the rate case as it is. And now when these additional money amounts come, we'll go through the fuel clause adjustment. Just made better sense than opening up the whole rate case again.
The thing with on the consent agenda with the auctioneer license application, is this something that happens often where you, since you're asked to judge whether someone should be licensed and they have a criminal record?
It's the first time in my 12 years. I don't know, Sue, if you recall any. Okay, in the 80s, apparently, there was one. But it's not a common occurrence.
Do you know the nature of his felony conviction?
There were two. And this is a case where the commission held a hearing because we wanted to gather more information on it. After initially denying the application, he had requested a hearing so we could gather more. One was from, I'm going to say 2001. It's over a decade old. That was related to subornation of perjury and misappropriation of funds, basically. It was when he was a member of the tribal council there, and he explained what the circumstances were in that case. The second was somewhat more recent, 2007. Does that sound right? Which was an assault charge, basically. Mm-hmm. Both federal cases. Of course, the reason they became federal in both cases was because they took place on reservation land. And it was good to have the opportunity to have the hearing. Senator Marsley from Rolette County was in and testified on behalf of Mr. DeLorme with regard to his standing within the community, which was very helpful in helping to answer some of the questions that we have to answer in an auctioneer case like that. And the additional question that we have to answer is whether we feel that the rehabilitation has been, that he successfully completed rehabilitation so that the past felonies won't impact present or future performance. And in this case, I think it did. He went through a number of courses that he's taken over the years that were part of that process and really directly, I thought, answered the questions that might have been outstanding. So it's a second chance, and I hope he uses it wisely and hope he has a successful career as an auctioneer.
What are you mentioned training courses? Training for what?
A number of things. I mean, of course, just for an auctioneer license, you have to have certain training through an auctioneer college. But in addition, through the prison system, things like anger management courses, just sort of general courses on personal responsibility, so on and so forth.
So he had these courses that you mentioned, and he came in and talked, and you liked the cut of his jib, so you thought, okay.
Well, it's a matter of, I mean, you have to answer two questions. One, does he have the standing in the community to believe that he'll be trustworthy and be able to transact auctioneer business in a responsible manner? And I think that was answered. And as I said, it was helpful having someone who was a formal tribal chair, a member of the legislature, who knows his family well, come in and say, within our community, yes, he's known for truthful action.
He's also...
And then number two is, has he served his time? Did he pay his debt to society? Did he do the things in... when he was serving his time that would indicate that he has been rehabilitated? And if both of those questions are answered in the affirmative, then under the law, he should be licensed.
And you initially rejected his application?
That's correct. I mean, based on the original application, you had an applicant with two felonies, and with lacking other information, we decided to deny it.
Just so
he's also
clear,
his auctions on the tribal ground as well. He's done actually some of this work on the reservation where he doesn't need a license, so he has performed in the past.
That I'm clear, his initial application just said, "Yeah, I've got two felony convictions," and so you, okay,
right. Well, I mean, you've got a felony conviction for assault. Probably to me, the more applicable one was the one from that was older actually, which had to do with misappropriation of funds, which would have more of a linkage to auctioneer and auction clerk type responsibilities.
You know, one of the things that compelled me, besides his personal testimony and his courage to even come in here and make his case, is that he did have a bond. I mean, a bonding company saw him, looked at his record, and decided he was worth the risk. And, that certainly speaks to their confidence, and that meant a lot to me as well. So we'll see. I think Tony said it well. Hopefully he uses his second chance wisely.
So Tony, is this your last meeting?
It may be. We don't know for 100% certain. I think it's probably likely that it is. It's 3 weeks until our next meeting, and
Jerry's on vacation.
There's always a little bit of paperwork in Washington that has to change hands. So as soon as the FERC has the appointment letter, then I can be sworn in any time after that. I suspect it will be before our next meeting, but don't know for certain. If the timing was such that you were getting sworn in, say, a day before a FERC open meeting, you might not do it then because you wouldn't be briefed on the things that you might be voting on. But hopefully within the next few days, I should have an exact swearing-in date.
Can you tell us any of your FERC perks?
FERC perks? I don't know. The charm of living in a major metropolitan area? Is that
FERC? Cement all around you?
Cement all, yeah.
And humidity at night.
A view of about that much of the capital if you sort of look over the, yeah.
Well, do you have anything to say for yourself in terms of your imminent departure from this world?
Well, you know what? I'll I will save that for the we're going to be doing it. It'll be a public ceremony, the swearing in, and we're going to combine it with it's sort of a tradition to have a coffee and cake and bars and things like that as you exit the Capitol. So we'll be combining those two things with a reception and a swearing in, probably in the Great Hall within the next few weeks.
Could Cheryl make scones for that? Because those are really good today.
Have they gone already?
Oh, I hope. If you didn't get one, you are. We should reconsider your appointment to FERC. They're if gone. You weren't smart enough to get up there and get one of those. They are spectacular. There might be one left. Sheldon put two of them together and frosted over and pretended it was one. But
if there is, there's a stampede on 15th right now. Okay. Are there any other questions? Oh, one thing that I bring to attention, which might be of some interest, because we've been asked about it a number of times by claimants in the Anderson Seed case, and I just gave myself a wicked paper cut, and other interested parties, is the status of legal counsel in the Anderson Seed case. On admin consent, we will be retaining an attorney. It's John Jensen is a special assistant attorney general. He's an attorney in Grand Forks, has a CPA license in addition to a law license, which actually would be quite helpful in a case like this where you have an insolvent elevator. Anderson Seed is one where the commission knows there is going to be a lot of legal legwork. There are a lot of outstanding questions. You have three jurisdictions with three different laws. You have grain and grain funds that have been in different accounts at different times. And it's going to be a significant case, and there is a significant amount of outstanding liability that is owed producers, not only in North Dakota, but in other states as well. And so we have gone out and hired legal counsel and look forward to having John on board to help that case and do our job as trustee, which is to try to get as much as we possibly can on behalf of the producers who have not been paid.
I had one addition.
Yes.
Annette's last day is June 1st. Thank you for your work here, Annette.
Oh, yeah, Annette.
So
thank you.
Is it? It's your.
You can say that definitively.
You can say that definitively.
Did you bring scones?
Thanks for helping.
I'm here until Friday.
Okay. Yes. That's good.
Thanks, Annette.
So where are you going?
The North Dakota School Board Association.
Okay. Well, that'll be different.
All right. Anything else for the good of the order? Anything else? All right. Hearing none, we'll close this portion of the meeting. We'll return at 11 a.m. for the administrative portion of the agenda.
Okay.